It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Chip Rupp is with us today. He's a former major college basketball player, played for Vanderbilt and for West Virginia, and that was after he was a big part of a Kentucky high school state championship team at Henry Clay in Lexington. He's been very successful in business in the medical sales field, and he's done all that while carrying a very famous last name. Chip, of course, is the grandson of the legendary Adolph Rupp, who was the head basketball coach at Kentucky for 42 years and the man for whom Rupp Arena, the home of the Wildcats, is named. And Chip, welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Catch us, first of all, up on your current life as things stand now, family, business, and all that.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you asking. So I'm a husband and a father of three. I have my wife of 30 years, we have three children. My oldest son, Frederick, lives here in Lexington. He's in commercial real estate. I have a middle daughter, Elizabeth, who lives in Northern Kentucky, and she is a practicing attorney. And then my youngest is in her senior year of college at UK, and yet to be determined what she chooses to do with life, but I'm sure it'll be great.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask about your connections to the university. Obviously, you've had the family connection for all your life, but how do you stay in touch? Are you just mainly a fan these days, or do you have some other connections that you stay a little closer to the program, or how does that work for you?
Well, I try to stay as close as possible. When Cal was coaching here, he was very welcoming to me and my family, and especially great to my father before he passed. And so he really embraced us and welcomed us in, and we felt like we were kind of, much closer than just a general fan. Tried to continue that on with Coach Pope. He's been great in a couple of face-to-face interactions, and I attend practices from time to time. So I think I have a little more access than just the general routine fan, but would always like to be a little closer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. Well, when I have someone in who has a background in basketball as a college player, I might ask, how did you get your start in basketball? But in your case, it's pretty obvious that it's been since day one would not be an understatement, I guess, would it?
Keith, you know, it's interesting. I love the game, but my first love was baseball.
Mm-hmm.
But that just was not an option. I mean, the family that I was born into, it, and this was not really so much for my grandfather because I was very young when he passed.
Mm-hmm.
But, it wasn't even my parents. It was just everyone that knew the family just assumed that I was going to be a basketball player. And so even though I really liked it and excelled at it, I didn't really have a choice but to pursue it. And so there was a lot of pressure to keep me involved in the game. And then there were these expectations that were probably too lofty, but you just felt like you were always having to pursue those and meet and exceed them.
And the thing is that you did become a college basketball player at the top level, and that takes an awful lot of work and commitment and desire in addition to just some talent and some height and other things that fall into it. I mean, you really have to dedicate yourself. So you were sort of pushing yourself in addition. It wasn't so much natural always then, right?
No, it wasn't. My mother was the one who told me this, but I think that as a player, I was a little bit more athletic than my dad was. He was a good shooter, but didn't really have much athleticism. In no way am I trying to say that I was some super athlete like you see by today's standards, but I was athletic enough to make it happen. But then I just had this inner drive, whether I don't know what was fueling it, maybe trying to meet and exceed other people's expectations, but I worked really hard at it. And I had a great knowledge and understanding of the game, which allowed me to compensate for some of my lack of athleticism. And it allowed me to achieve, my goal, which was to play Division I basketball. The interesting thing is my college career did not live up to the same expectations that my success was leading up to college. And, as a kid, one of the things that I was always told by my parents was to be a goal setter. And, the three criteria for a goal is that it has to be written, it has to be realistic, and it has to be attainable. And so, throughout my early years, I always kept that up on my mirror in my bathroom that I wanted to be a Division I basketball player. But the interesting thing was once I accomplished that, I didn't reset my goals. And so I really think that my less than illustrious college career, even though I was there and would not trade the experience for anything in the world, I always had this little bit in the back of my head that says, what could I have been better and more successful at that level if I had done what got me to that level? Mm-hmm. And that was reset my goals at that point. And, you know, I think that I just had such a realistic grasp on my abilities that I never really envisioned that I would ever be a professional. So once I achieved the Division I level, I probably should have reset goals and said, I want to be the most successful player I can possibly be at this level. And I just never did that. So mm-hmm. I guess we'll never know.
Yeah, so it's something you can look back on with a lot of satisfaction, of course, to achieve that. But at the same time, as you say, resetting the goals could have been important at that time. But a lot of success, of course, in basketball. And then beyond that, I want to go back to the days you mentioned. You were very young when your grandfather passed away in 1977, right? And but at the same time, I've seen pictures of you with him. And so you have some memories of him and knowing that. He was who he was in college basketball. I assume that you were a part of things as you in your younger years got to meet a lot of players, be around them. What do you recall about those years?
Yeah, it's amazing. I was truly blessed, and as a kid, you don't realize that. So, you know, there were many times that I would go to after he retired is what I remember the most. And he still maintained an office at Memorial Coliseum. Mm-hmm. So he would take me to the office with him while he would do paperwork. And that was truly his out-of-home office. So a lot of the stuff that he did with regards to his farming or other things he was doing in life, he did out of that office. Mm-hmm. And then we'd stroll out the tunnels there at Memorial and, you know, we'd watch Coach Hall's early teams practice. And so I had access to those guys and got to watch a lot of practice. Got to meet some amazing people, Lee Rose, mm-hmm. When they came to town to play in the, I think it was in a regional, had a chance to meet him, John Wooden, just had a lot of access that most people don't. It was great to actually just be standing there off to the side and overhearing the interaction going on between my grandfather and these other public figures. It was a pretty neat experience.
Yeah, just to be around it, and then usually kids have favorite players, and you got to meet some of yours personally. Did you have some favorite players that you followed?
Yeah, well, I've stated it before. Actually, I told him, so Goose Givens was one of the people that, you know, I wanted to emulate. Uh-huh. And I just thought his game was amazing. Great shooter, silky smooth. Yeah. I loved his persona. And so I always wore number 21 for that reason. Mm-hmm. And I told him, and he, you know, now as we get older, he doesn't really feel like he's maybe that much older than I am, that I should have been looking up to him. But he was one of the first that I really wanted to be like.
They were marking the 50th season of basketball at Rupp Arena this year, and I remember just in the last couple of years seeing the photos at the dedication game, and Adolph Rupp was there, of course, and talked to the crowd, as I recall, and was out on the court. What's your memory of the first games at Rupp Arena, the first season at Rupp Arena? Do you anything stand out in your mind? You were very young at the time, of course.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, I was very young. I do remember when we would enter the arena, and I would go to most games. My dad did not go to a whole lot of the games, but my mom would drive my grandfather, and then my sister and I would go with him, and we had the four tickets right there on the front row. So, obviously, I remember the blue Lazy Boy recliner that they put out on the front row to accommodate him. And I remember when we'd come in at that time period, as he was walking in from the tunnel to his seat, and the crowd knows he'd come in, there would be this roar, and they'd all say, "Hello, Uncle Adolph." Mm-hmm. And they chanted that, and he'd always wave back to the crowd. And I do remember that vividly, and enjoyed, you know, going to those games with him.
Yeah, that was a tradition that had carried over from the Coliseum days and during his active coaching career. I was a student when he was in his last couple of years as the head coach, and that was always a part of any pregame routine, was that they would greet him and then usually greet Kaywood Ledford from across the court, too. Students would do that in unison. Well, you came to his games or the games at his arena when you were playing basketball as a very young man. Did he come to your games? Was he able to do that?
So he did. It was really interesting. I went to Sayre School here in Lexington through sixth grade. And during that time period, you know, I don't know if a whole lot of people knew this, but my grandfather and Dale Brown, the former coach at LSU, mm-hmm. were really good friends. And so even when Coach Brown would come to town to play against then Coach Hall's teams, he would come out to the house to visit my grandfather and just pick his brain. And so one Saturday I was there playing in a parochial league game, Sarah versus St. Peter's gold team. And I look up in the stands and there's my grandfather and Dale Brown at the at my elementary school game. Mm-hmm. And he would come out and support that. And at that time I was playing T-ball over at Ecton Park. And so he came to a few games and met our team, and he supported as much as time would allow. Mm-hmm.
And even though we know him for his basketball accomplishments, but he had other segments of his life too, including farming. And I was going to ask you about that, but that was part of your experience as his grandson, wasn't it, to accompany him and be yeah. part of that life too? What was that like?
Yeah, so his two loves outside of basketball, and he was very well-rounded. And a lot of people just thought it was basketball and had an impression of him that wasn't really, I think, as accurate as it could have been. But his two loves, he loved the Shriners organization. So he was a past potentate of the Shrine, and he loved his farm and his registered Hereford cattle herd. So, you know, he would go to the farm routinely. He never drove, though. So he'd have one of his former managers drive him or my mother, but he never drove that I remember. And they would drive him to the farm, and so he would always invite me to go. And then when we get out to the farm, he somehow had the way to manipulate it that it was a big treat and honor for me to be allowed to jump out at every gate and open the gate until the car went through. And then I didn't learn until many years later that that wasn't quite the treat that maybe he positioned it to be. But at the time, I thought it was the coolest thing ever.
Oh, yeah. So you got to spend a lot of what we would call quality time with him on the farm. What do you think made him, of course, he grew up in rural Kansas in the early part of the 20th century. And so he was part of that background as a resident of a rural area. But what do you think drove his farming interest? What made him such an avid farmer?
You know, that's a great question. And I don't have a specific answer for you. I don't think he was as passionate about the crop side of the business. He was more passionate about his registered Hereford cattle. And I mean, I think that to be a perfect registered Hereford cattle or cow, there were certain criteria they had to meet. And I mean, he was very stringent about making sure that his herd met those specifications. And if he would have a calf, no matter how magnificent it looked, that didn't quite meet all the specs, he'd weed them out, they'd cull it out and sell it at the stockyard. And so he only allowed the best of the best to be part of his herd. And I think it was kind of similar in his mind to the way he ran his basketball program.
Yeah, that sounds like a similar approach to what we've heard other players say, and say that that's the way he went about practice and coaching in the games and all of that. So that was a big part of his life. I mean, that's right there as far as his professional activity is concerned. That's right there almost with basketball, isn't it?
So it's interesting. It was. So after he retired, he was offered the opportunity to be the head coach at Duke University, and because of mandatory retirement, that's why he exited University of Kentucky, but he still felt like he had a lot to offer for the game. And so he was really intrigued by that opportunity. But, you know, even with all the wins he had and all the success, there really wasn't any money in coaching back then. I think his last year salary at Kentucky may have been $60,000. Mm-hmm. So I can't imagine that Duke offered him much more. And he was strongly considering that position. But the farm manager that took care of his herd became ill during that time period, and he passed on the coaching opportunity because he said he couldn't leave his farm. And I don't think it was so much the passion of it. He had to supplement his income with that, and so he had to be hands-on to make sure that there was a smooth transition of his farming operation in order to make ends meet.
Mm-hmm. We noticed even as fans in the last couple of years that he was coaching, he began to have some health issues at that time, and mm-hmm. that really carried over until his death later in 1977. But I mean, he was able to enjoy some retirement years, but I'm sure you saw him decline a little bit at that time, and that must have been pretty tough for you at that time.
Yeah, it was. You know, as a young child, your parents kind of protect you from some of the information. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't really realize how bad his diabetes was, but he had experienced a lot of foot issues, had multiple foot surgeries, had to wear special orthopedic shoes to keep from breaking down the skin. And that was all, you know, happening right in front of my eyes. So I knew there was a change to his wardrobe, how well he got around. And, yeah, it's tough to see anybody you know and love decline at the end. But, you know, despite those issues, I mean, he was still a great grandfather to me and my sister. We'd go to his house all the time and play cards with him, and he'd spend countless hours with him, with us. And, you know, the public eye just never got to see that side of him.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll come back to him a little bit later, but I want to ask you, as we move on from the 70s to the 80s, you got to play on a state championship team, and that's worth a separate conversation by itself, because these players, as we approach a tournament time each year, everybody plays for that, and you got to play on the state championship team for Henry Clay in 1983. Tell me about that experience.
That was a thrill of a lifetime. You know, at that time period, high school was... you began your sophomore year. It didn't include freshmen. So, you know, I came from Morton Middle School to Henry Clay High School and had an opportunity to play for Al Pruitt, who was one of the greats. Mm-hmm. And, you know, early in the season, he decided that I was going to be not just a JV player, but a varsity player and have an opportunity to contribute when available. But I knew we had an amazing team. And then just to go through that season, you know, Coach Pruitt lost his wife that year. And so we dedicated the season to him and performing in her memory. And so to see it all culminate with a championship in a triple overtime game against Carlisle County, I mean, you couldn't have written a better script.
Yeah, that was such a classic game. To this day remains a classic game, and really always will. It's going to be hard to top a triple overtime game. As a player, what's your mindset as you get into that? Because the stakes they couldn't be higher. You're playing for a state championship,
yeah.
And the tension, I wouldn't think, couldn't be any greater. What was that like?
You could have cut the tension with a knife. We had such an amazing team, and it was a super athletic team. Carlisle County was just the opposite. So the coach of Carlisle County at that time was a guy named Craner Sloan, and he had to put together a game plan that would allow that game to be competitive, because on paper it was not. Mm-hmm. And from the very beginning, they had a big guy named John Tyler who went on to play at Transylvania. Yeah. They got the tip and held the ball, and there was no shot clock. And so, you know, at the end of the game, I don't remember what the final score was, but it was in the 20s. And I think the final score ended up being like 33-31. And it just, they did whatever they had to do, but it was true like watching a heavyweight fight, punch, counterpunch. I mean, there was never larger than a 4-point swing the entire game. And it was, I'm sure it was hard for the guys that played the majority of the minutes, but it was hard also as a bench player to watch it because it was so tense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one where even if you're a fan, you feel like you've played by the end of the game, because it really does take it out of you. The thing that you hope for as a fan, or at least I did as I got older, was that the game wouldn't end on somebody making a mistake, or somebody walked with the ball, or you know, missed late free throws or something like that. So you want it to be a good ending, but it is a classic ending, a classic game.
It's one you can't forget. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's pictures out there that still exist that show an amazing angled shot of the final tip-in that won the game. And we had a player named Greg Bates who had an amazing vertical. And you can see the picture of him up above the rim, the ball coming off of his fingertips, the Rupp Arena scoreboard in the corner showing triple zeros, and the score was still tied, and the ball going through the net. And it's an iconic photo, and it's still etched in my memory.
Yeah, this would be a tremendous memory wherever the game had been played. But the fact that it's played in Rupp Arena, what did that mean to you at that time and then since then?
Well, at the time that happened, it really didn't register. What did register were the previous three games where I would check into the game and to walk out there and to look down on the Rupp Arena circle. And at that time, it's at Rupp Arena. Mm-hmm. I do recall that I kind of looked down, and I'd been on the floor many times and I'd shot in there before, but to be in on that stage at that moment, it was kind of surreal. Mm-hmm. It really was.
Well, following the high school career, and well, let me go back to one final thing too. You got to, I would assume, cut down the nets.
We did.
It's a tradition after the game, and that must have just, well, it's supposed to be the icing on the cake, but that must have been really, really extra special to be able to cut down the nets and hold the piece of the net up in Rupp Arena.
It truly was. I mean, I've still got that piece of net. It's still at my mother's house, actually. But, yeah, no, it's the thrill of a lifetime. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we were talking about goal setting and all that. I mean, one of the things you always wanted as a kid growing up is to win a Sweet 16. Mm. And I went on to experience success at the collegiate level, but that Sweet 16 thing is always going to be there, and it's something that I truly cherish. And it was a special moment with the 12 other guys that I was on the team with that we can all share, and we actually got together last year. Our team was inducted into the Lexington African American Sports Hall of Fame as a team, and all but one player was there, so we're all still alive, and it was great to see those guys, and it's just like you turn back time when you get to spend time with those guys and share that one moment together.
Well, following the high school career at Henry Clay, you've got an opportunity to play college basketball, and of course your name is forever associated with Kentucky. But at that time, Joe Hall was nearing what turned out to be his retirement year. He, unlike your grandfather, he did not want to stay and coach into his 60s, and was ready to give it up, and that coincided with your senior year as far as your recruitment was concerned. Tell me about that and what transpired.
So growing up, you know, any kid growing up in the Bluegrass wants to play for the University of Kentucky, and I was no different. The difference was when my grandfather coached, so many of his teams were built on Kentucky players, kids from the mountains, and then he would speckle in a Cotton Nash or a Dan Issel or someone, and it would be, you know, the perfect formula for success. But there was a strong contingent from Kentucky. When Coach Hall came in, then the whole thing changed, and not in a bad way. They started recruiting nationally. At that time, you know, everybody's, instead of five stars, it was McDonald's All-Americans. And, I mean, he just had a stable full of them. And so, as I said earlier, you know, I had a pretty realistic understanding of my abilities and where I fit. And so pretty early on, about my sophomore year, I realized that may not be the best fit for me just because I'm not going to be a McDonald's All-American. So I didn't really think about it much. And I was playing in a Christmas tournament at Lexington Catholic. And at that time, they set up like a press row on the stage there in the gymnasium. And I noticed Coach Hall was there. And after the game, he had someone tell Coach Pruitt, my coach, that he'd like to talk to me. So I went up on the stage, and another game was going on. And he said, you know, I'm going to retire. You need to know that at the end of this year, but I think you deserve to be a member of the University of Kentucky basketball team, and I'd like to offer you a scholarship and the opportunity to be part of our team. And he said, I hope you'll consider it, and I really did. I talked to my dad, and there was a lot of reasons why I wanted to say yes, but at the end of the day, I still kept coming back to, I felt like I don't really fit with these other guys. Maybe it's a token gesture, and I kind of wanted to make it on my own. And so I chose a different path, but was incredibly honored to receive that offer nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. And when you say you talked to your dad, of course, he did play for his father, Adolph Rupp.
He did.
And so, he was speaking with a great deal of knowledge when he was talking with you about that, making that decision. So you ended up playing at Vanderbilt for a former UK player, C.M. Newton, who played for Adolph Rupp back in the early 50s, a very highly respected coach, and a person who was known to recruit a lot of players from Kentucky and built a lot of success during his time at Vanderbilt based on guys he recruited in this state.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that was really attractive. Loved my time with Coach Newton. Didn't know much about him before that. I mean, I knew he played for my grandfather, but I didn't have any routine contact. But I did know that he started recruiting the state very, very hard, going back to a guy named Phil Cox from Kaywood and Brett Burrow from North Hardin. And so you saw that there was this Kentucky pipeline. And then my senior year, Frank Cornett from Lexington, Barry Goheen from Marshall County, and I had routine conversations, and we all decided we were going to go and take the ride together at Vanderbilt and see if we could do something great.
Mm-hmm. And you were there, what, a couple of years, 3 years?
So I was there, I was there 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm. And so then, as I recall, you had an injury or something that derailed you for a little while and caused you maybe to lose some ground to other players.
Good memory. Yeah. Well, I think we did have some good success at Vanderbilt, which elevated the recruiting opportunities. And, you know, honestly, I had a couple of injuries in a year that I thought was going to be make or break for me as far as finding more time on the court. And a couple of young guys came in that they recruited that were better than I was. And so I realized, you know, there's not going to be an opportunity for me to get in front of these guys. So I either have to be happy being a bench player for the remainder of my career, or I got to choose another path. And so, you know, at 18, 19 years old, it's amazing how many different people can get in your ear and convince you that another pathway might be better for you. And so I chose to move in a different direction. It was very difficult to leave my friends and to leave Coach Newton, but I wanted to try to find somewhere where I could find a way onto the court. And so I left at Christmas of my sophomore year.
And then went to West Virginia.
I did.
And so that also had a connection to Kentucky, and that Gail Catlett was an assistant here, and he was the head coach and having a lot of success at that time, as I recall, at West Virginia.
We had a great run at West Virginia. And so the year that I transferred in, obviously I wasn't eligible to play, but I practiced with him daily. That year, our team made it to the Sweet 16 and lost in the Meadowlands to Duke on a nail biter of a game. Obviously, I was not contributing because I was sitting out. But then we went on to have a couple other good seasons there, and I had a little bit more success there than I did at Vanderbilt. But the biggest difference was I tore my ACL while I was sitting out, and so it delayed my return a little bit, and that just took away any athleticism that I really had. And so I had to be happy being still, for the most part, a reserve player, playing a little bit more than I did at Vanderbilt.
Now, at that time, as it looked like playing basketball was going to come to an end for you, were you okay with that? Or what was your feeling as you came to the end of your college career?
Well, you're incredibly sad to see something you've put so much time into come to an end. But as I stated, I never envisioned that I'd be a professional player. So, you know, I was okay with it, and I was ready to close that chapter in my life and move on to the next. And it was with a little bit of sadness, but I'm kind of one that compartmentalizes things pretty well. So I knew that was time. I'd achieved all that I could there. Let's close that, and then let's turn our eyes to the horizon for what's next.
Yeah, and so you can appreciate what you've done, but at the same time, it's not going to be something that's going to burden you in the sense that you would be carrying regrets for a while.
Not at all. And the beauty of it, even though I didn't taste a whole lot of success on the court, I learned a lot of great life lessons from being a part of those teams, from being mentored by Coach Catlett and Coach Newton, and all those life experiences have really helped to benefit me in my professional life, so they were very valuable to me.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about moving into business, because the type of business that you're in, I'm sure very, very competitive, and one that you really have to be, there's always a lot of self-motivation to do that, especially when you're first getting started with it. And so you do have to be able to leave the basketball chapter behind and be ready to focus full time. I would think if you had not been able to do that, it would have been pretty hard to succeed in that kind of business, wouldn't it? Because you need a clear head and a good approach.
No, I completely agree. It in my line of work, you know, people that do it just for a paycheck can do fine. But the people that really succeed and exceed expectations and do well for a long time are motivated by something else. And that's, you've got to be a self-starter. You've got to have this internal drive to be the best of the best. And a lot of those lessons I learned as an athlete, and I implemented them into my professional life. And then it's honestly been just a complete learning experience from previous successes or failures that's evolved into what we're doing today.
You mentioned very early in our conversation that baseball was your favorite, and you've pointed out in some previous interviews that you got to coach Walker Buehler, the major league pitcher who had gone on to a lot of success, and particularly with the Dodgers a couple of years back in the World Series, and had a great career at Vanderbilt, and you had an opportunity to coach him at the Little League level, wasn't
it? I did.
Yeah.
I did. So I want to make sure that I put everything in perspective there. I didn't find Walker as a 9-year-old. I inherited him as a 12-year-old. Mm-hmm. That year they reclassified the birth date for Little League. So I had him for a 12th season twice, because he got to play 2 years as a 12-year-old. And he was pretty much finished by the time I had a chance to coach him, but it was fun to watch him, and he was just such a dominant player at that age. But then, you know, I kind of lost track of him a little bit during what would be considered like the Babe Ruth years. And then I saw him re-arrive on the scene at Henry Clay High School as a pitcher. And I started watching from afar, and I went to watch him play a few games, and his velocity continued to pick up, and then he just blossomed from there. And until his second Tommy John, I mean, what a phenomenal run he had, even at the major league level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember there was one particular game, might have been a World Series game with the Dodgers, and he's being taken out of the game, and he's walking off the field, and of course everyone's standing and applauding, and you can see in the background one of the people standing and applauding is Sandy Koufax, and I thought, well, yeah, what a moment that must have been for him, and then you could at least have a little bit of time of sharing that moment with him.
Yeah, no, it was, I remember the picture you're talking about. I've had such a thrill watching his success. I'm not sure that he's at the end. He is a grinder, and he loves the big stage. And even though this year he had, some bumps in the road with the Red Sox before he's moved to the Phillies, it'll be interesting to see how the offseason unfolds for him. And I think he still has a few more major league seasons in front of him.
Well, I wanted to, getting back to your grandfather, Adolph Rupp, He also enjoyed, in addition to farming, if there was one other professional activity that seemed to interest him as much as anything else, it was public speaking. He really enjoyed getting in front of people and talking, didn't he?
He did. He was very witty. He had a dry sense of humor. But what I will tell you is I'll share one memory. So it was, I think it was the year that he died. I think the Final Four was in Atlanta in 1977. And he knew that he was sick. I did not know at that time. And so he said, I want you to go with me to the Final Four. So the two of us went to the Final Four together. And his travel companion was one of his managers that kind of went to take care of him. And so we went to the NABC meeting that morning. And that's where every coach that's really not participating in the Final Four is there. And I did not know when this was going to transpire until it happened. And so the manager and I went, and we sat in the back of the room. And I remember watching him walk in, and he was given the keynote address. They knew he was going to pass, and so it was his kind of Jimmy V moment. And he went up and gave a great speech. The place was a standing ovation for an extended period of time, and then getting to see him interact with the other NABC coaches as he left the stage was really cool to watch, and to actually see him in his environment speak was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. And part of his story, his legacy, and of course some of these things have been brought to light in one way or another long after his death, is the attitudes toward race, and particularly recruiting of black players at a time when there were none in the SEC. And some of this was happening at about the time you were born. I certainly wouldn't expect you to have any firsthand understanding of that. But as things have happened over the years, how have you tried to handle that? Because a lot of that does, I guess, in a sense, right now, even fall to you as to be a family spokesperson on his legacy in that regard. How do you try to handle that?
Well, I've tried to. So it's really interesting, Keith, when this all surfaced, if you recall, this all dates back to that monumental game in 1966 against Texas Western. However, after that game, no one ever said a word about race until the Final Four was in Lexington in, what was that, 1983?
85.
Mm-hmm. So it was 1985. And then you see Curry Kirkpatrick put out a Sports Illustrated article claiming that he was in the locker room at that time period. But you went through this 17-year, 19-year time period where you never heard a word about it, and then all of a sudden it bursts on the scene.
And by this time, he had passed away years earlier.
Well, that was the challenge. He had passed away years earlier. So, honestly, all protection for, defamation, slander, anything that you could defend, or just to defend yourself personally, that opportunity didn't exist. So then it becomes this sensationalized account by one so-called eyewitness. And then it started to get some legs from there. And early on, when my dad and the family asked, how should we defend this? How should we approach this? And they said, oh, it won't go anywhere. Just be quiet and it'll blow over. But it really didn't. So a lot of my adult life, I've had to try to defend this. And, based on everything that I know, I don't think that there's really anything that should have to be defended. But nonetheless, it has taken on a life of its own, and it's pretty hurtful as one of the last male Rupp heirs is to have to spend a lot of time discussing it and talking about it and defending it, because I don't think there's really anything that needed to be defended.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's, of course, his legacy in basketball will never be forgotten either, as far as the on-the-court experiences. I know people have said they, I think former coaches have been quoted as saying that they would pay to watch Adolph Rupp's teams practice. They were so disciplined, and yet he was so innovative too. As you learned, I'm sure as you learned about his early part of his career. I mean, he was way out in front in many trends in basketball, particularly just the pace of the game, and really set the pace in the Southeastern Conference. And sometimes people want to take away from that by saying, well, the other schools weren't emphasizing that, but they could have. And you know, he played the schedule that was there, and he also made an effort to play all around the country too. Kentucky basketball became known nationwide, didn't
it? No, he was willing to play anyone anywhere. He wanted to get the Kentucky name out nationwide. You know, I think he was really innovative in that aspect, and his execution and precision on the court was unprecedented at that time. It is interesting to note, though, I do have a great picture in my study at home of him playing at Kansas for Fog Allen, who the Kansas Fieldhouse is named after. Mm-hmm. The assistant coach on that team was the guy that invented the game,
yes,
James Naismith.
Yes, uh-huh.
And so he had a pretty good background to build off of from his days at Kansas, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And we've talked a little bit about this, but just to sum it up, how would you describe your relationship with him? I mean, you got to experience basketball with him, but also going to the farm, and also I would think just being your grandfather. There were some times when neither of those things figured into it. It was just your personal time with him. But how would you sum it all up?
Yeah, so that's really interesting. I mean, most people thought that he was this gruff, hard, crusted, sarcastic, witty guy. But to me, he was just my grandfather. I mean, he was always available. He was loving. I know people will find that hard to believe, but we just had some great times together. He did not really ever give me any advice about anything that I recall. But, I mean, he always made himself available, whether it was going to the farm, whether it was, you know, he loved Dairy Queen, and he'd take me to Dairy Queen, and we would, you know, there was a Dairy Queen at that time up on Duke Road, not far from where he lived, mm-hmm. and they knew him, and he'd go in the door, and, you know, they'd load up a Brazier burger at that time with extra pickles. That's what he wanted, and he was just a grandfather to me. I mean, he was not this superhuman icon that other people saw. He was just, it was granddad, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we appreciate you coming in and sharing these memories, and he will never be forgotten, of course, and by Kentucky basketball fans. And the building is there with his name, your family's name on it, and I'm sure it's continues to be a great source of pride for you. And thanks so much for doing this today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay.
You've been listening to the WUKY Sports Page with your host, Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced at the WUKY studios by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to the Sports Page through iTunes, Google Play, or at our website, wuky.org.